To have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. I am so excited to welcome back the wonderful and talented director and producer and screenwriter and author, Tom Blomquist. He's a very interesting man, and we have a very fun talk. Here's Tom. Hi, Tom. Welcome back to the show.
Well, hello, Sherry. Thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm really happy to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Life is good here in Charleston, South Carolina, and I have no complaints, which is saying a lot, and very grateful for that.
No bad storms or hurricanes or any of that stuff?
Oh, no, it's not hurricane season, and we dodged one last year. We didn't have anything here, so nothing like Florida. So all is well, you know, and we... The nice thing about hurricanes, if there is a nice thing, is that you have plenty of warning. Unlike tornadoes, where you may or may not get warning, and it may or may not be long warning, and then of course earthquakes, you get no warning. So there's something about them saying, well, there's a storm off the west coast of Africa, and we'll keep an eye on it. You know, and for 2 weeks they're tracking it. You know, that's gives you plenty of time to either fortify or pack your stuff or whatever you need to do. And so it's as brutal as those are, you usually have some warning, and sometimes quite a bit.
It's really the flooding that causes all the damage, isn't it?
Flooding is a huge problem, you know. That's for sure. We saw that in Florida and Fort Myers. But, the winds, you know, if you get 130 mile an hour wind and it's a sideways storm, and you get debris flowing, you know, the tree limbs and furniture flying, and then it's like, you know, Wizard of Oz, you know. So that causes a lot of damage, and then of course flooding. If you're near the water, really near the water, and it's in Charleston, because we're the low country and everything is at or kind of a little above or a little below sea level. If it's high tide and a hurricane hits, even a severe tropical storm, you may get a 6 or 8 or 12 foot storm surge that goes inland. And you don't know, you know, how far inland, but it could be several miles, because you also have rivers and streams that are filling up with water, and that water is trying to flow out to the ocean. So if you're caught in the middle of that, it can get pretty ugly. And a lot of areas of Charleston flood every time it rains, basically, and, you know, since colonial days, and they're trying to fix it. They're trying to find remedies, but it's difficult.
Yeah, especially for low-lying areas, you guys, New Orleans, stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this whole part of the country is, you know, low country, and all the whole continent kind of slopes to the ocean in this direction, and so... you know, where we live, we're high enough above sea level that we don't need flood insurance, but we have it anyway, you know, because in a catastrophic storm, you don't know what might happen, and you want to be prepared if you can, you know?
Yeah, yeah, of course. I mean, do you guys have emergency kits like we do? We have emergency kits for earthquakes, so I figure you guys have to have emergency kits for...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we're my wife and I are pretty well prepared for that. And last time we had a hurricane, we stayed. We didn't evacuate. We hunkered down, and it was wild, you know. But we were fine, and our neighborhood was fine. A lot of tree limbs, a lot of leaves, but everything else was, you know, it was just a life experience, that was for sure.
It's always scary.
Yep.
this is a corny question. I mean, you're a writer, so, but, so you have to be a reader. Have you read any good books?
Well, it's interesting. Yes, I have read a couple of very interesting books. But how much I read is a lot, probably less than you would think, only because I find that when I'm writing, my mind is in what I'm writing. You know, the characters are talking to me. They wake me up in the middle of the night. I'm literally writing down what they're saying at 3 a.m. And I find it unsatisfying to be reading somebody else's fiction. Sometimes watching fiction on TV, because not only did I write so much TV in that part of my life, but it's like I see the story points coming. I feel like I've seen it before. So even the best of the shows, I just like, okay, I see this. And I turned to my wife and said, well, you know, she did it in the first 5 minutes. And 99% of the time I'm right, because you can just kind of, you learn to kind of see the plot elements being put in motion. And so I don't find that as satisfying. So, you know, for TV, we tend to watch a lot of home improvement shows and sitcoms and lighthearted movies, because it's very different than what I write. And but there's a writer, a new writer named Mary Vaughn Fent, who has just published her second novel, and she's kind of a contemporary historic fiction writer. And Lisa DeVita is another one. She published her first novel a couple of years ago, and now she's doing a trilogy of novels about Queen Margaret and of England, and very interesting writer and excellent writer. And there's a couple others that I look at when I have time. Richard Viteri is a writer I've met and I know, and Dennis Palumbo is a mystery writer in Los Angeles and a clinical therapist, very interesting guy. But like I said, I only have so much brain space. I have always found that, and when I'm writing, it's all consuming for me, and I'm writing most of the time. So yeah, I work 7 days a week on my novels, and when I get in the zone, you know, I hate leaving the zone until I'm finished. And that means, what am I going to do? I hate reading, you know, one chapter at a time, two chapters at a time, like before bed type of thing. I can't do that. When I sit down to read, I want to read the whole thing. So that means I will dedicate a weekend or several days to just reading a book. Well, that's satisfying, except I feel guilty that it's at the expense of the thing that I'm writing, and my characters who are still chirping in my ear, and they want, you know, they talk and you type, you know, and they're talking and they're alive and well, and they have things to say. And when you get in the zone, your job is not to write, but it's to transcribe what they tell you, because mm-hmm. they are very real and they're very active. And in the middle of the night, they wake me up, and I'm standing in the kitchen with a legal pad writing as fast as I can, like this, I'm downloading something from somewhere, you know, and it's all them talking. And then I wake up in the morning and go, what the heck was this? You know, but more times than not, it makes eminent sense, and it fits somewhere in the book. And it's a very strange process, but that's my process, and it may be very different for other people.
I have the same thing about the characters talking to me. The first time that happened, I was a little worried that I was going out of my mind.
Well, yeah, it's an eccentricity. In fact, the new novel that I'm finishing up is about screenwriters. It's a kind of a dark comedy about Hollywood and kind of how nuts we all are, and eccentric maybe is a kinder word. But there's a lot of that kind of discussion in it between these writers, because whether you're a great actor or a musician or whatever, these things do occupy your mind in a way that's different than someone who doesn't do that, either for a living or as a hobby. And I may have told the story on your show once before, but I heard an interview with Paul McCartney once, and they said, well, you know, John, I think John Lennon had just been killed, and they said, but, you know, what is your obituary going to say? So I could tell you exactly what I was going to say. Paul McCartney, former Beatle, former member of Wings, a composer of Yesterday, died today. And they said, really, why that? He said, well, the irony is, he said, it's the best thing I'll ever write, and I didn't write it. He said, I dreamt it. And he said, I have a notepad next to my bed, and I woke up one morning, and there was Yesterday written out. He said, I have no recollection of doing it. I was sound asleep, and it's the greatest thing I'll ever do, and I can't actually tell you that I wrote it. I have no conscious memory of writing it. And he said, you know, I've got songs that I've worked, labored at for weeks that are horrible, and I wouldn't play them for anybody, but the greatest thing I'll ever do came to me in a dream. And there's physiological reasons for that. I went to a lecture on that, the physiology of creativity, believe it or not, and it all of your creativity happens in the back of your head, in the reptilian brain. All anything involuntary, your eyes blinking, your heart beating, all that is controlled in the back, and the intellectual part of your brain is in the front. So for your creativity to get utilized, it has to travel from the back to the front, and things get in the way along the pathway, and so those are writer's block kind of things. And that's why you have all these great ideas in the shower or in the middle of the night. You wake up and you have these epiphanies about things, because when your mind is at rest, it clears that pathway and that stuff can come forward. And so you are most creative when your mind is resting. So I had a writing teacher once who said, if you're struggling with something in a script or a book, just go to bed. And you'll sleep, but your mind will continue to work. Your subconscious mind will continue to wrestle through the problem. And more times than not, you'll wake up with the answer. And that's what he was trying to say in a non-scientific way. But it's very true. So that's why you have these characters and these ideas in the middle of the night. And my process, you know, my wife just laughs at me, because, I mean, there have been times when, you know, I'll get up in the morning and I'll have half a legal pad full of single-spaced just chicken scratch from what I was kind of downloading. It's the only way I'm channeling it. It maybe is another way of saying it. And I've learned over the years that when I have a thought like that, I have to write it down. It's not like you could say, oh, I'll remember that in the morning, because I never do. So I always get up, and I, even tired as I might be and half groggy, I will write it all down, and without any editorializing, without any intellectual input from me whatsoever, whatever is in my brain, I just get it on paper, then I go back to bed. And you know, a couple of the best television episodes I ever wrote literally were written in that exact fashion, the whole episode. And both of my novels to date, same thing. You know, the you get these characters, when you know what you're writing about and you know who's in it and you know the journey they're on, you get out of the way and let them tell you, because they are real. And any of your writer guests will probably say versions of the same thing, and probably have, but you don't sit and say, okay, now let's see, what would be a good thing for Sherry to say here to Tom? And then you sit and ponder, what would Sherry say to Tom? No, you just relax, and Sherry's in your head, and she will say something, and you write it down, because Sherry knows probably better than you do what it is that she wants to be said, and the character Sherry. And so that's my process, and it is all-consuming, and it's a long answer to your question, but I have a real problem, not a problem, but it's I can't, you know, sit down and read something until I'm finished, you know, or if I'm going to take a week off, which, you know, you do periodically, you're kind of burned out and you're looking for something to distract you, then it's great, you know, then I get these novels that people send me or that I have picked up along the way, that I have a stack of them, and you know, on a shelf that I've never read, I always wanted to. That's a good time to pick one up, and it's pure pleasure then, because I've shut down everything and I'm just refreshing. But those are few and far between.
Yeah, I can understand that. It's funny because when I was in college, I was always writing stories. I was acting and I was writing stories. I was writing plays and I was always doing something.
Yep.
But it was like I got the idea about sleeping from Shirley MacLaine's book Out on the Limb. She was working on the thing and she couldn't figure out what to do with something, and she took her notepads and everything, put it beside her on her bed, put the covers over her head and went to sleep, and when she woke up she knew exactly what to do. And I thought, oh, what a good idea.
Oh, but that's a version of what my writing teacher Robert Dennis said, and it is an amazing thing. If you relax into a problem, many times it'll get solved. People can pray as a version of that. They can just meditate as a version of that. There's all kinds of ways to relax yourself and give yourself over to whatever it is that you need to resolve or to think about or to create. And it's kind of a freaky way to make a living, I'll say, or even as an avocation, to live your life that way. But I don't know any other way, you know, frankly, of living. And when I'm not writing something, I'm not entirely comfortable, you know, in my own kind of skin, in a way. I like hanging out with these characters and being with them, and I've always been that way, you know. And but like you, I wrote in school and all, but it was mostly journalism kind of things. But then when I started doing fiction, TV shows, there's nothing like it. You know, you go into their world and you occupy their world with them, and you are among them in a very unique way. And I mean, the same way a reader of a great novel or you're watching a great movie and you get swept into the story. You're not an observer anymore. You're somehow participating, and it's a fly on the wall. And it's like that for writers. If you're in the zone, I call it. But if you're not in the zone, then it's a lot of hard work and word craft. But if you're in the zone, it's just extraordinary, really extraordinary.
I always, because of the characters in my head, I always thought, and it even happens when I'm reading a book, after I finish the book, the characters were still there, and they continue for a little time, not forever, but
sure.
but it's just, I kind of felt like there's a, you know, the string theory about universes of being side by side by side. I thought there was a universe for fiction, for characters in fiction. There's a separate, like, one of the string universes is characters from fiction.
Well, you know, who's to say that's not true? But in a very real sense, it's like a song you can't get out of your head. You know, you hear it on the radio, and then, you know, you literally, it's driving you crazy because that song plays over and over and over again. There's something about the way creativity lands on the consumer of it, you know, that can be very profound in all the definitions of the word profound. And and when somebody can do that and kind of smack a reader or a viewer, you know, upside the head with what they've done, and you're thinking about it for days and you know, reliving scenes that you've seen. And it's happens to me all the time. I'll watch something and late at night, you know, I can't go to sleep, so I'll flip on the TV, and it could be anything, an old episode of Murder, She Wrote, doesn't matter what it is, and I just want to go to sleep, and I'm just kind of waiting for my body to shut down, and you know, I'm reliving some of those scenes, you know, in when I go to bed. What's that all about? Well, because that's, somebody wrote something, created something, that had that kind of impact. And, you know, that's what we strive for. You know, it's, you know, with the books I'm writing, you know, when somebody, when it resonates with somebody on a level other than just passive entertainment, boy, that's a great feeling. And, mm-hmm. and the TV shows that I used to do, you know, whether it's a fan letter that comes through or a reviewer that says something or a colleague in the industry, and you realize that you touched something, you touched a nerve, an awareness, boy, that's just extraordinary. And it's, you know, I kind of feel sorry for people who don't have that in their lives on mm-hmm. some level. You don't have to do it professionally, but just to be able to, you know, paint a painting and show it at a weekend art fair and have people like it, even if they don't buy it. You know, if you don't have something like that in your life, I don't know how people kind of how do they function if you don't have some kind of a reciprocal relationship with the world around you. And that's what this is. It's reciprocal. You know, the thing about fiction writing, whether it's TV shows or movies or novels or plays, is that our job as writers is both to interpret life experiences and intensify them for people. Mm-hmm. So that's the job. And so, and we've probably talked about this on your show once before, but it's really true. You know, it's not just a love story. It's the most romantic love story. It's not just a scary scene. It's the scariest scene in the history of scary scenes. And so you interpret what it's like to be alive and under certain circumstances, and then you intensify those experiences, those emotions for people, for their escape and for their connection to what you've done. And you know, what a cool job, you know.
Yeah.
to tell people what you think about things and intensify them, whatever it is. It could be your political views, your social views, your personal relationship views, your historical perspectives. It doesn't matter what it is. You get to share what you think about stuff thematically with the world, and then when it lands, like you're describing, you know, where you read a book or see a movie and it's still playing in your head for days, boy, that's wonderful. That's success. Doesn't matter if somebody got paid for it or not. That's success.
Yeah, and it's always been like that. Even when I was a kid, this is really corny, but I was two shows I was obsessed with when I was a little girl. One was Bewitched and one was That Girl. And I used to walk home. My dad used to take me to school, and most days I would walk home. But I walked home by myself, so I would create an entire thing about either Bewitched or That Girl where I was in it, and I was acting as a part of it. It sounds crazy, but that's how I made it to, I was entertaining myself on my way home from school by pretending I was part of Samantha's family and that I was the cousin and I was a witch. And I mean, I had this whole storyline going.
Well, but you know what? It's not weird or crazy. It may be to some people, but if they think back, the marvelous thing about actors especially is when we're children, we all have the ability to have imaginary friends and playing, you know, and building forts out of cardboard boxes and girls and, you know, playing with dolls and all that. We have the wonderful free imagination. And then as we get older, we lose it. Most people lose it. And your adult kind of rules of life take over. Actors either never lose it, or they go through extensive training to recapture it so they can reconstitute it for audiences. Because, as you know, acting is not acting. Acting is being the other character. Mm-hmm. You don't pretend. You're not pretending anything. You're you are in it. You believe it's true. You're the more truthful your perspective, your performance, the more effective it is. So it's not that weird. And writers do the same thing. We're constantly imagining whatever it is, the perfect crime, the perfect this, the what, it never, once you start thinking along those lines, it does not go away. And it's it's a very different kind of set of muscles, I'll call them, mentally, than the average person. But they have fantasies and imaginations too, imaginings, I guess, is a better way of putting it. But it's maybe not as active. It's been repressed by their lives, the problems of their lives, and the responsibilities of their lives, and so forth, or a difficult past that becomes like an obstacle to them accessing this. Whatever it is, there's a lot of people like that. And I go back to my other comment of, I feel sorry for people that don't get to experience that, because I know for a fact that while you were a little girl doing that, you still do it now to some extent.
I do.
Because you're an artist, and that stuff doesn't go away. You know, it's like the old thing about the big chunk of granite, and it's like, well, I don't make anything. I just take away the parts that don't belong there. The artist sees the end product and they just chip away at the excess. And so that's the same kind of point of view, I think, for you and all artists and me, that you it's a different way to look at the world and to experience the world, and then you share that with people, whatever it is. And by the way, speaking of the Bewitched family, Dick Sargent was a friend of ours, Samantha's second husband, mm-hmm. on the show, and what a wonderful guy he was, and had some wonderful stories, because he and Elizabeth Montgomery were very, very close friends. And so just, you mentioned that, I just bring it up. I actually got to be a peripheral 18th generation member of that family by just simply being a friend of Dick's.
That is so cool. I mean, and did you know that Dick Sargent was actually William Asher's first choice? But he couldn't do it because he was doing another show. So they had Dick York. Which was great.
I don't remember that, but I'm not surprised. But Dick York was phenomenal.
He was.
But,
they both were.
Yeah. And the people think that Dick Sargent was cast because he resembled Dick York, and had some of the same kind of mannerisms, the big take, we'd call it, the big reactions. But in fact, I know that he was a kind of a part of that. I had forgotten maybe that I knew that. It's been so long now, but anyway, wonderful guy, and I miss him, because we've had many social activities with a mutual group of friends, and he was really a wonderful man.
We were talking in the green room about Phantom of the Opera, and I was telling you about the curtain call, and what you were saying reminded me of something. When I went to see the Phantom the first time, I was in my 20s, and I floated home on that music, and it lasted at least 2 or 3 weeks. And I bought the cassettes at the theater, and I probably drove my family nuts, because I was playing that all the time.
Yep, of course, yeah. But again, a classic story retold and repackaged in a new, very vibrant way, with spectacular production values and all of that, and it does, stuff like that does stay with you, and that is what success of art is. It's like the painting that you buy and you have hanging in the hallway, on the way to the bedroom or whatever, that gives you pleasure every time you see it. even though you don't see it every time you walk by it, you know, you get used to things. But then every once in a while you look at it and go, oh, wow, and it gives you pleasure. And that's art. You know, it's not necessarily a dynamic thing. It's not intensity, but there's a pleasure and, you know, some kind of pheromones or something are released in your brain, and it happens in all kinds of different ways. It's really interesting.
And my mother was an artist, and I have a bunch. My brother and I both have a lot of her stuff, and I feel that way. I mean, I feel that way about stuff I bought too. But like you said, you see it all the time because it's hanging on your wall. But when I look at it, sometimes it brings my mom back.
Well, yes, and of course it does. And, you know, we assign special meaning, if not emotion, to objects all the time. You know, it's the paperweight that was on your grandfather's desk and whatever, you know. And in a way, it does keep them with us, if not literally, figuratively. And then when you get something like a work of art that someone close to you created, I mean, that is them. You know, you're investing, she invested a part of herself, big part of herself at that moment in time in that painting. And now you get to share that very directly with her and she with you after all this time. And you know, my dad, when he was a kid, I think in high school, took a shop class, and he made a desk, a really nice desk, and that was the desk my brothers and I always did our homework on, and my younger brother has the desk now. It was really well made, and it's kind of shocking that he knew how to do stuff like that. But every time I would sit down, you know, long after he was gone, and do something at that desk, you know, I was near him. Mm-hmm. And it isn't corny, it's real. He smoothed those edges, he did this, he did that, he made this, he cut that. And so, you know, you hope as a writer that you know, some old TV episode that one of your guests or I might have done, if somebody sees it and it entertains them or touches them or makes them laugh or whatever, you know, that can happen 100 years from now, and that's a great feeling, you know, that you did leave something behind. And you know, how many times have you looked at an acting performance? We're talking about Bewitched. If you see a reunion of that, you know, all those people are gone now.
Yeah.
But they are still somewhere in the ether, you know, and you get to enjoy them all over again, and it may have great meaning for you, whatever it is, the show, your favorite show as a child, or your favorite movie, you know, when you were in college, or who knows what. But that's part of what the whole art thing is about, I think. And again, it's a privilege to be a part of that world and to know that some of this stuff will resonate for a long, long time, and maybe forever, and that's cool.
And that is one of the things, and I think it's part of my creative mind, is that I remember, I may not remember the name of the episode, but I remember every TV show and every movie, pretty much verbatim, that I've ever loved. I can't remember what I ate yesterday, but I can tell you, at the first 5 seconds of a MASH episode, what it's about.
Yeah. Isn't that something? And, I mean, if you just really stop and think about that, somebody changed your life, you know, at the time when you saw it, because it resonated deeply enough. And you've probably seen it a few times since, and then you see it again, and it all comes back. There's like this, you know, actors call it sense memory, you know, trying to reconstitute an emotional experience for whatever role they're in. And it's kind of that. You get back in touch with something, you know, it's like sense of smell. You know, you walk into a room, and I remember I was on location on a TV show, and we went to some restaurant. It was in an old house, and I went, for some reason, the back, maybe the restroom or something, and I went down some stairs, and I stopped, and it was like somebody had smacked me in the face. It was the smell of my grandparents' house in Michigan when I was like 6 years old, and it was a musty, slightly, maybe some mineral oil on the wood, whatever it was. There was a blend of scents that stopped me, and I actually pulled my phone out and called my older brother and said, "Oh my God, I've just been at Grandma and Grandpa's house in my head." And I told him about it. He remembered exactly the smell I was talking about, and it had been, you know, 50 years since we were there and experienced it. But that's the same kind of thing you're talking about. The first couple of minutes of a show, and all this stuff comes back to you, and you know, whatever it is, a certain scent of perfume, and you remember your Aunt Bertha, you know, and it's so specific, and all of these memories and emotions come back. Of course, as writers, we try to replicate that for readers, you know, sometimes successfully, but you try to take them into moments that we all share as human beings, to try to get across whatever's happening, the feeling of the moment, the emotion of the moment, the tension of the moment, with those kinds of cues. The sound cues, smells, the touch, you know, the crunch of the peanut shell under your feet, you know, in a sports bar or whatever. Those things all have meaning when they're assigned to certain things, whether it's in a dramatic scene you're creating or in somebody's life. Because we've all had experiences, sensory experiences that are in common, and the what I'm loving about writing novels now is that I get to do that, as opposed to trying to defer some of those things to the production designer and the director and the costumer and the sound team and all of that. And hope that it all comes together and gets across to everybody, that you get to do that on your own as the primary creative artist and not just a member of a team. It's really cool. And then when you hit those things, like, you know, whatever it is, like the Bewitched, the little girl walking down the street pretending she's in Bewitched, that's such a unique, it's hard to even put this in words, isn't it? But it's a privilege to be a part of that, either to be able to do it or to experience it when somebody does it really well and it impacts you. It's phenomenal.
Sometimes I don't tell people that because it sounds weird to them, but it's just something that I've always done. It could be a book. I'm a big fan of Agatha Christie, and if I'm rereading an Agatha Christie, it doesn't shut off when I finish the chapter and I'm going to go to sleep. It goes, it keeps going.
Oh, yeah. And also, I just blanked on her name, Interview with a Vampire.
Anne Rice.
Yeah. You know, same thing. I mean, you're talking about very intense connections. Emotional, sensory connections in that writing, that and the various screen versions that comes across. It's you know, real skills, that's for sure.
Now, you're a television guy, so I have to ask this question. You know how many different adaptions certain writers have of their stories? Does
sure.
it ever bother you if they take it in sort of a strange direction that actually doesn't seem to fit the story at all? Or do you, because you're a writer and you are a screenwriter, you just, well, that's just the way it is. I mean, does it bother you when it doesn't seem to fit?
Ah, okay. When somebody has adapted a book or something that I like, and they made choices that, well, I don't know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the word yes, sure, it bothers me, like it would bother anybody. What people need to remember is that, number one, this is not an exact science; it's art. How do you take a 400 or 800 page novel and turn it into a 100 or 120 page screenplay?
Mm-hmm.
Right off the bat, something's got to go. Because in a screenplay, you know, it's not margin to margin, you know, single spaced like a book would be. The dialogue is in a very narrow format in down the center, you know, 2 or 3 inches wide. And so it may be 100 or 120 pages, but it's actually, if you put it in a Microsoft Word format like a novel would be, it would be a lot less than that. So how do you take 400 pages of something that you love and turn it into the equivalent of 70 pages or 75 pages? That's a magic trick, and it's really hard to do. There's rules of adaptation that, you know, are helpful, you know, like you don't undermine or reverse the meaning or the morals of the source material. You it's called fidelity. You have fidelity to the original material. What is the thing that made it compelling in the first place? You try to save that. But also, you have the obligation. It's not just a privilege, but the obligation to change things, because all the plots are not going to be there. They can't be. All the characters are not going to be there. They can't be. You don't have 400 pages. You have, you know, far less than that. So primary decisions have to be made, tough decisions. What do we leave out and what do we save? And if we're saving it, we probably can't save it in the exact same form it was in the novel. You're going to have to condense things, combine things, maybe take detours, you know, eliminate things and go from A to L and skip a bunch of stuff in between, because you don't have the page count. You don't have the screen time. You've got a 2-hour movie, and if you shot everything as it was originally written, kind of like a novel, you know, it'd be a 15 or 20 hour movie. And unless it's for a TV miniseries, which now, of course, is popular, where you can do more of, you can include more of the original material, then you have to make some tough decisions. I think it's one reason that many times novelists struggle and fail doing adaptations of their own work, because everything is precious to them. And they don't have the objectivity of, well, what's really crucial and what's less crucial. And can we live without the less crucial and just stay with the most important? And it's a specific set of writing skills, frankly. And analyzing the material objectively is really, really essential. You know, it's like a doctor has to analyze all the lab work and all the radiology of the patient, and you have to be objective about it. And then your allegiance, in the case of a screenwriter adapting a novel, is not to the novel, it's to the movie. You revered the novel, you understand why somebody wanted to make it into a movie. Now your allegiance is to the movie. What's the best movie we can make, drawing from the primary elements that must be honored, and other stuff isn't going to be there. And if people are too possessive of those things, then they're going to be disappointed, and they probably shouldn't see the movie, you know. And other times, choices are made, and they actually improve the overall impact of the story, even though all the interstitial steps of getting from beginning to the end of the story have changed. Sometimes there's 8 different ways you can get to the same ending, but perhaps some of them are more efficient than others. And that's an art form. When I worked on the TV series Christie, based on Catherine Marshall's novel, people had tried to make that into a movie for years, and they couldn't do it. And Patricia Green was a writer I worked, was a friend of mine, a writer I wound up working for, somehow figured out how to tell that story as a two-hour TV pilot. First thing she, if you ever read the book, it's a very dense novel, a lot of kind of episodic things that happened to this girl over the course of her first year as a kind of been a coming-of-age story. And the mistake was people tried to tell that whole story. Well, you can't do it effectively. So Pat figured out how to tell the first part of the book, make it feel like a complete movie, and kept the essence of all the things in that first part of the book alive and well, some of it verbatim, some of it completely invented by her. And people that saw that movie would swear that it was word for word right out of the book, and it was not. Mm-hmm. It was a magic trick. And it was a pilot for a series, but had the series not been ordered, everybody would have been perfectly happy to see that movie, and they would have felt satisfied, even though it was just the first portion of the book that she covered. And then we had 2 years of the series. Some of the episodes were drawn pretty closely to elements of the novel, and others were completely invented, both to shore up primary elements, but also to tell a more complete story. Now that we had a whole, you know, we had like 22 of these to do a year, so now you can really get into the minutiae of life and the relationships, and the book didn't have nearly enough of them for that. You know, Catherine Marshall didn't plan on doing a weekly TV series. And the trick is, like with an actor, you know, giving a truthful performance, you have to have truthful script elements that are so good, so close, so attached to the spirit of the original, of the source material, that people would swear to you that it came right out of the novel. And that's really hard to do. And kudos to Pat Green, because she figured it out, and she steered that bus for me, the episodes I wrote, and all the episodes written by the other writers. They felt like they came right out of the pages of the book, and other people had tried that and not succeeded. I mean, several writers and some good ones, they just couldn't figure out how to do it. So it's, I use the word magic trick, but it's kind of is a magic trick. And some people are better magicians than others.
It's funny, you made me remember something. There were a couple of movies that were like that, that really sticks out to me. One of them is Sense of Sensibility, written by Emma Thompson back in the 90s.
Yeah.
She got it. And the thing is that there were parts of it that were not in the book that she created. But people said, oh, I'm so glad you kept that scene from the book, because it's one of my favorite scenes. And she's like, okay.
Well, that's right. Exactly. But that's what I'm talking about. She had fidelity to the source material. And the fidelity that she understood what the material was about, to the point where she could take this large printed story and boil it down into its essence. And some of the essence was manifested differently than the written page, and nobody knew it. And it happened to us on Christie quite a few times. There were entire characters that people said, oh my, I'm so glad, I love that. That was my favorite character from the book. No, that was completely imaginary. we thought the writing staff or Pat Green thought of that. That wasn't in the book, but that meant it worked. And there's been some of the greatest movies ever made were adaptations, and they didn't keep much of the original book, and yet it still felt like it, you know, honored the book. And others were just, you know, probably disasters. And I don't know, if this were easy, you know, everybody would successfully adapt things. But it's a tooth pull sometimes. You know, the stories about Francis Coppola and the Godfather novel are, you know, legendary. You know that he and Mario Puzo worked very hard on the screenplay of that movie, the first movie, and then when they were shooting it, he didn't even shoot from the script. He only referred to the novel for all the textures and colors and things that he wanted to remember. He had millions of notes. There's a wonderful video on YouTube of Coppola's preparation for The Godfather, and he goes through his director's notebook, and it's worth looking at if anybody really wants to see how a master director and writer will approach something with great, great sincerity and reverence. But he actually took the novel and pulled it apart page by page and put it into a binder, and then he, you know, put those pages on other pages and then wrote in the margins all the things he wanted to remember. Now, the script was written, and there was additional dialogue and all of the stuff that you put in a script, because, you know, you have to have people talking to each other in scenes in a different way than a novel. But his fidelity was to what Mario Puzo wrote and the way he wrote it, and he wanted to make sure he never forgot the feeling of the scenes. And people would swear that, you know, he shot the novel, you know, verbatim. Well, he didn't. But when you look at all three Godfather movies, it feels like that's the entire novel. And he covered everything, but there's a lot of new and wonderful invention in that.
It's interesting because sometimes when a creator, somebody, I'm thinking, I just read for the first time 39 Steps. I've seen the movie a zillion times with Robert Downey. And there's so much in the movie that wasn't in the book. I mean, actually, there was a lot added to it and taken out, and they changed things and everything. But both were great. You know, I mean, first of all, it's Hitchcock, so of course it's great. But it was... It's so interesting, because when I read 39 Steps, I'm like, I'm expecting the stuff that I've seen in the movie, and when it wasn't there, I'm like, oh. But it didn't disappoint me at the same time. It was a really good book. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah. No, of course it makes sense. And the thing about... Remember, all books are not the same, just like all movies are not the same. So you have, you know, the novelist creates everything, describes everything that appears in the novel, and including what characters are thinking and what they're remembering and all of those, all what their emotions are. Well, on screen, you can't do that. You know, you can't say Sherry walked in the room and remembered her childhood when she was 10 years old, skipping down the street pretending she was... I mean, you can't do that. How do you show that on screen? Well, maybe a flashback. Is the flashback appropriate there, like it was in the novel? It might be, but it also... Doing flashbacks can be an encumberment to the forward motion of a movie. So maybe you don't want that. Maybe she just tells somebody... in a new scene, you know, her new best friend that's not in the novel, you know, where she tells, you know, Lola that, you know, I couldn't believe, I was like, I was pretending I was in Bewitched and I loved her. Well, that scene's not in the book, but maybe that's how the screenwriter gets across Sherry's exuberance and her imagination as a 10-year-old girl. And, you know, some novels don't have a lot of plot. Some novels are very experiential. There's a lot of description and there's a lot of mood, but there's not really that much plot. Well, that's not going to fly in a movie. You're going to wind up with a really bad, like watching paint dry kind of movie. Movies have a certain mandate. You have to move forward. You have to, you know, people are used to things having a beginning and a middle and an end, and it's got to have a point to it. And so sometimes you have to invent plot elements that don't exist in the book, just to get to the to whatever the finale is in a more entertaining fashion. And if you do it right, people are going to swear it was in the book, and if not, then you know, so be it. But many writers have tried and failed to adapt their favorite books, you know, and there's lots of reasons why that can happen, that's for sure, and including the person that wrote the novel. I can tell you that if somebody were to come to me tomorrow and said about my first book, especially Silent Partners, we want to make this movie, we want you to do the screenplay. And I'm a screenwriter,
mm-hmm.
and I'm being very honest, I would have to think about it, because there's aspects of the novel that I don't know how I would, sitting here today, transpose into screenplay format. It's very psychological. What do? You know, you have voiceovers, and then I walked in the room and I was terrified. Well, that's a style of screenwriting. I don't know that I would want to do that. So now what do? How do you convey the kind of inner monologue of a character where so much of it is on based on that? How do you tell that in proactive forward motion movie writing? And I don't know for absolute certainty that I could. I would probably just out of pride want to try, but I don't know that I would. It might be better for somebody else to do it, and if they have a question, they can call me. But it's an interesting question, because I now have come to respect the differences between the craft of screenwriting and the craft of writing prose in a way that I never did or had, you know, before. You know, it's a completely different thing. And so then to go back and try to put this into the screenplay format, it would maybe be like putting the round peg in the square hole type of thing. I don't know. And I'm somebody that was perfectly comfortable writing screenplays for a lot of years, but now I'm doing this and I like
the
kind of expansive view of the story world that I get to have now. And when you do screenplay, you're not the primary artist. And there are a lot of other artists that are going to have things to say and do with your work. And I'm kind of getting spoiled. You know, I really, it's like, this is cool to be God, you know, and sit here and do what I want to do the way I want to do it and have people like it or whatever. It's really cool.
There's a freedom with novel writing that you would never have in any kind of thing like plays or screenplays or anything like that, because it's the same thing, because I write plays, that there's a format, there's a way to do it. I mean, you can break the rules a little bit when you're writing a play, but you have to basically, you're still writing a play.
That's right.
And
oh no, absolutely.
So I think it's the same thing that you're talking about as a screenwriter. It's that there's a format. There's a way to do it. You have a certain amount of pages. You have a certain acts, and you have a certain amount of pages within those acts, and everything. There's a lot of rules. You can break the rules, but you still can't be like a novelist where you're going to have 300 pages or 400 pages.
Well, but I'll even now impose a larger set of restrictions, which will probably make anybody listening to this never want to be a screenwriter. No, but there's real world aspects that get imposed on you when you're writing a screenplay. I don't care who you are as a screenwriter. You write your screenplay, whether it's an original or an adaptation, and you've got 30 speaking parts, you've got 50 locations, you've got a bunch of production elements, you're going to make some storms, you're going to have blow some buildings up, all kinds of things are happening, right? And then somebody says, yes, we're going to make your movie, Sherry, but we're prepared to spend $20 million making this. We budgeted your script as written, and it's $50 million. You have to make some choices because we're not shooting everything you wrote. Now you have to figure out, okay, well, what can I? Well, I can combine some characters, the lesser characters. I can eliminate some characters completely. I can eliminate some locations, because every time you go to a location, you have to rent the location, you have to dress the location. With the art department, you have to move the company there when trucks, and it's a big deal. So maybe I just hit you have fewer locations. Maybe I don't have as much action or you know, like powers of nature type of things. You know, maybe I don't have the hurricane, you know, blow the town away. Maybe there's another way to put the town at risk without having to create a hurricane and blow the sets apart. And so you have to make choices that are real world practical choices, like every family sitting down doing a budget. Well, okay, how much money do we have this month? Which bills are we not going to pay? And so in a novel, you write whatever you want to write. It doesn't matter. You can have 500 locations. If it works for the story, 500 locations. But trust me, if it's going to get filmed, it's somebody else's money. And if it's their money, they're going to have everything to say about, here's what we liked about what you wrote. Here's what we hated what you wrote. And here's what we're never going to spend a dime on what you wrote. Fix it. And then if you can't, then they'll either tell you what they want changed specifically, or they'll bring someone else who will, which is one reason you see multiple writers credited on so many movies and TV shows, is that at some point either the first writer didn't work out, the first writer couldn't figure out how to solve their problems, someone else imposed and said, hey, I have a better idea, let's get somebody else in here to get a different take on this story, and you wind up sometimes with many writers, and some of your other guests and I have all done credit arbitrations for the Writers Guild, where Writers Guild members volunteer to figure out who gets what credit for writing an episode or a movie. And I've done many of these over the years. Steve Sears, who we both know, has done a bunch of these as well. And it's complicated because you have, let's say there's three writers. You have writer A, writer B, writer C. You never know their names. And you read what writer A submitted as their work. Then you read what writer B did. And then you read writer C, which is the shooting draft. And you have to figure out who contributed the most at what stage to both the story and to the actual completed screenplay. And there are rules that you're supposed to follow to try to adjudicate that. And three different writers read the same material anonymously. We don't know who the writers are. We don't know who each other might be. And then you vote on how the end credits should be. And if, you know, it's a majority rule type of thing. Very complicated, and especially if there's source material. So now you're reading, let's say, a novel or a short story or a magazine article or something. That's where it all came from. And then the first writer did an adaptation that they didn't want to go with. Second writer comes in and changes all the character names and changes some dialogue, but changes nothing of actual substance. And they want full credit for it. And then the third writer comes in and changes a few things. But maybe what they did was they just went back to the original source material and put more of that in. And who gets the correct credit for that? And it's not perfect, but it's a very good system. It's actually been upheld in the courts that the Writers Guild is the official legal determiner of screen credit for movies and TV. Because you have professional writers doing this anonymously, and we've all been subjected to this. We've all had things rewritten of ours, or we've all rewritten somebody else's material and then it has to get arbitrated. who wrote the story, who wrote the teleplay, and what combination. Was it one person or three people divided up? And it can get it's very time consuming to do that. I'll tell you that. Sometimes you're reading many versions of things. You're reading a treatment that somebody wrote, and then they threw that out. Somebody else wrote a treatment, and then the third writer comes in and goes back to the first treatment that a different guy wrote, and your job is to figure it out fairly, and both for their career, screen credit career, but also the residuals that they might get, or even profit sharing if they have that in their contract. It is dependent on whether or not they get screen credit or not.
Gosh, I wouldn't want to do that. I would feel bad.
Well, it's funny. You don't feel bad. I mean, it's not that I've never felt bad, but the truth is we're all professionals. And the writers also, they write a little a statement that goes with their work so the reviewer panel can see what it is. You know, they describe the process for them. You know, they hired me to do this. I read the book. I did an outline. And blah 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 blah. But I've read the final shooting script, and I think it'd be fair for the last writer and me to share credit for this movie. And you know, that's a fair, you know, kind of thing for the first writer to say. Mm-hmm. Then the last writer comes in and says, "We threw everything out. I did everything from scratch, and I should get sole credit for this." Well, then you look at his or her work and you compare it to the writer A's work and you go, you know, this is very heavily based on what the original writer did and very, very heavily based in all the right ways on what the original source material was. So this person's coming in trying to basically undercut somebody else's work and kind of claim it as their own. Not that they didn't contribute a lot, but maybe not enough to get sole credit. Certainly not enough to get sole credit. Maybe not even enough to get any credit, because there's a rule that for a writer to get a subsequent writer to get credit over the original writer, you have to contribute substantially more to the overall project than the first writer. Well, that's a lot. You know, if somebody wrote, you know, multiple drafts, you know, and then they were dismissed from the project and somebody came in to rewrite them, that person has to change everything, you know, I mean, not everything, over half. And you're talking about thematically and characters, not just character names. That's an old trick. They come in, change the names, and try to get credit for it. But you don't just go in and change dialogue around and the scene is essentially the same. It has to be a really substantial rewrite for them to get any credit at all. And so a lot of times the last person goes away mad because they've convinced themselves that they wrote it. Well, no, they did a good job on what they did, but the first writer or even the first two writers maybe really wrote it, and the other person polished it. Well, polishing is not really writing, as any TV producer will tell you. You know, I don't know how many scripts I've rewritten and polished, and I never even asked for a credit because I did my job. They hired me to be the person to kind of get it ready for production, but the first writer did the best they could, and they did a good job, and it wasn't perfect. Well, so what? You know, but there are people who will, sadly, there are producers and directors who will do everything possible to take something that already exists and then to change it just enough so they can get at least some credit for it because they want the residuals later. And that's kind of cheesy, I think.
Yeah.
And you find yourself getting a little irritated at some of the statements, the grandiose statements these writers make, trying to persuade you that they really wrote this and what the other person wrote is irrelevant. And we've all been there, and we all know it may not be a lot left in their of their work in the finished product, but there's enough there that somebody built on top of it. You didn't start over from scratch. You didn't face a blank computer screen like the first writer did. You know, you came in after they did all this work, and their work should be honored. The first writer is almost always honored, at least with a shared credit, sometimes with a story credit. But again, these things are complicated, just like the adaptations. And then, okay, well, not just an adaptation, but it's rewrites and revisions, and who did what, and to what extent did they do it?
We're almost at the end. So I just want to know about your book. What's the latest one about, or can you tell me?
Well, I can tell you that, thank you for asking. It's a revenge comedy. My second novel, A Deviant Thinking, was a revenge comedy. And I really had a lot of fun writing that. And the response has been really strong. And I was in a mischievous mood when I wrote that. And I'm still in a mischievous mood. This one is about Hollywood TV writers. So it's about people like Steve Sears and me and probably many of your other guests. We are all part, composite elements of these characters, I assure you. And it's a little, it's not Get Shorty, but it's closest to Get Shorty of anything I can think of, in that it's a dark satire of Hollywood, of TV in particular, and, the kind of vacuous elitism of it all, and the pretentiousness of at least some of the people that you deal with, and many of the eccentricities you and I have been talking about writing, and kind of how strange, if not goofy, some of this process is, and the people who experience it and write these things. So I'm making fun of myself and all my friends and people I've worked with, and the process of what that was with the agents and the actors and the studio heads and all of that. So I'm having a lot of fun with it. It ought to be out, I think, this summer. And it's called Poster Boys is the title. And, if I get it right, it'll really be fun for everybody. And we'll see if I get it right or not. But I'm having just a whopping good time, I'll tell you, because now that I'm, I think maybe the reason I can do this novel now is that I no longer live in Los Angeles. This is our fifth year here now in Charleston. And I have just enough time away from all of that to see it with a different clarity. And I still, of course, have friends that are there and in the business and teaching screenwriting and what have you. But I'm now far enough away that I can view it maybe a little more acerbically than when I was there, and I'm having fun.
That's terrific. We're at the end. Do you have a website? And what social media are you on?
The website is tomblumquist.com, and somebody wanted to reach me, the best way is I'm on Facebook as Tom Blumquist, and just message me and I can get back to you. But at the website, there's stuff about me, stuff about my two novels, and some trailers and commercials and whatever that I've prepared for those that I also had fun doing, since I'm a filmmaker. One thing I can do is make a kind of a movie trailer about a book that I wrote. So I've had a good time. The first novel, Silent Partners, the trailer is big and epic and kind of movie-like, big studio movie feel. And the others, because Devious Thinking is a silly, con game kind of romp of a story, all of the promos are silly. And it got to the point where people were shooting them and sending them to me. One of them, Bella Shaw, was one of the original CNN anchors for many years, very popular newscaster. And she really liked the book and had spent a lot of time in Rome, where the story is mostly set. And so she wrote and shot a promo. She put on old lady makeup and sent me this thing. Said, gee, I hope you like this. Well, it's hilarious. And I mean, if you don't read the book, at least look at Bella Shaw's promo on my website, because it is hilarious. And, you know, I added music and a title at the end kind of thing. But so a couple of people did that. There's a magician in Houston who was a world-renowned magician, and he did a wonderful kind of riff on my book. And it's so fun because, you know, if people get that involved in what they've read or what they've heard about, it's just another one of those things you and I are talking about where something landed with somebody to the point where they were motivated to take some kind of action, you know, and in this case, to share their humor with me. And there's a guy who's a voiceover artist, and he lives in Oklahoma City. And he came up with an idea and contacted me to promote Devious Thinking. And it was a brilliant idea, and the promo was called Devious Confessions. So he and another voiceover artist who lives in Los Angeles recorded the commercial and sent it to me. And then my job was to find footage that fit what they had performed. And it's, I mean, what they did was amazing, and the way it all came together was kind of hilarious. And I've, you know, what can I say? It's as much fun as writing the book itself when you get to, you know, kind of riff on the creativity of people like that who are top industry professionals in their field, and to build on that and kind of finish it visually was a filmmaking challenge, but also was my book and how fun for me, you know?
I think it's terrific. I loved your book, Devious. I thought it was great.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. I want to thank you for... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just thank you so much. I'm sitting smiling hearing you say that, because as a writer, you know when somebody doesn't hate what you did, you know, it's very rewarding. And, you know, these things, I don't blow these out in 3 or 4 months like, you know, famous authors often do. You know, it takes me a couple of years to get one of these done. And so when you put that much time and energy and creativity and thinking into it, craft, you're trying to learn the craft of doing this, you know, it's very rewarding to hear that, especially from a fellow writer. So thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. It was great. I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to come on my show. I really appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me. As always, this is really enjoyable to just sit and kick back and talk about this stuff. I feel like we could do this for hours. So have me back if anybody, unless people object. If they do, sorry, folks. But if they don't object, then, you know, I'd love to come back sometime.
Well, I'm the one who makes that choice, so you're definitely going to come back.
There could be a mutiny. There could be a coup, you know, of your listeners. They could, you know, be marching with torches on the castle. So we have to be careful about that.
All right, well. I don't think they will. I think they'll like you. I think they like you very much. Anyway, thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry.